Now it was Hanukkah time again, and Mrs. Milgram was gone, and Uncle Shepsel had walked outside, being a Lutheran now, and I was in. On the first day, Mr. Milgram told me the story of Hanukkah, how long ago the Greeks tried to destroy everything Jewish. See, this is not the first time. How the Jews were outnumbered and had no chance against the Greeks but beat them anyway. How the Jews celebrated by lighting an oil lamp. But the celebration would have to be short because there was only enough oil to last for one day. And then a miracle happened. The oil lasted for 8 days. And so Hanukkah is 8 days when we remember that time, and we remember to be happy and proud to be Jews, and that we will always survive. This is our time. We celebrate ourselves. We must be happy now. We must never forget how to be happy. Never forget. Happy? I had not heard that word since Mr. Milgram spoke it at the last Hanukkah. I asked him the question that had been on my mind since then. Tata, what is happy? He looked at me, and at the ceiling, and back at me. Did you ever taste an orange? He said. No, I said, but I heard of them. Are they real? Never mind. He stared at me some more. Did you ever... He stopped and shook his head. After more staring, he said, Were you ever cold? And then you were warm. I thought of sleeping with the boys under the braided rug, cold, then warm. Yes, I blurted. Was that happy? He smiled. That was happy. I felt again the cuddled tent of warmth. Sometimes I would stick my nose out to better feel the warmth on the rest of me. Under the rug. No, he said. He tapped my chest. Happy is here. He tapped his own chest. Here. I looked down past my chin. Inside? Inside. It was getting crowded in there. First angel, now happy. It seemed there was more to me than cabbage and turnips. I looked at Janina sitting potato-faced on the floor. She hadn't smiled since the burning cow. Janina does not have happy. He squeezed my shoulder. He smiled sadly. No. Mr. Milgram took the silver candle holder from the pill cabinet and lit the first of 8 candles. The twins came over to stare at the flame. The other new people stayed on their side of the room. Gunshots echoed in the streets as Mr. Milgram said words over the candle flame. The flame gave a faint yellow tint to his frozen breath. Then he sang a song. Sing, Janina, he said. But Janina only gave a grunt or two. Then he pulled Janina and me to our feet, and the twins also, and he made us all hold hands, and we danced in a circle while Mr. Milgram sang, and the candle flame quivered, and somebody screamed in the night. The smile never left Mr. Milgram's face. I copied his smile as best I could. Janina's shoulders slumped, and her shoes dragged across the floor. I wondered if the orphans were dancing in a circle. Then Mr. Milgram took something and another something from his coat pocket. They were wrapped in newspaper. He gave one to Janina, one to me. I tore mine open. It was a comb. I couldn't believe it. I remembered the canister full of combs in the barber shop. I remembered Uri combing my hair. Now I had my very own. I threw off my cap and sank the comb like a spade into my hair. It stuck. I pulled. I couldn't move it. I dropped the comb and began tearing apart the thatch of hair with my fingers. I tried the comb again, using all my strength. I was finally able to pull the comb through my hair. I could feel the lice and their eggs peppering the back of my neck. I heard them ticking onto the floor. In the light of the candle, I combed and combed and combed my hair. Not until the next day did I notice that Janina's gift was still wrapped in newspaper. "You're not going to open it?" I said. She pouted, "No." So I opened it. It was a comb just like mine. I gave it to her. She threw it on the floor. I picked it up and began combing her curly brown hair. "See?" I said. "Doesn't that feel good? And it's better than picking out lice with our fingers." She did not answer. She did not smile. She did not stop me from combing. On the second day of Hanukkah, when Mr. Milgram went for the silver candle holder, it was gone. Mr. Milgram seemed surprised, but I wasn't. In my world, things existed to be stolen. With the other family in the room, everyone knew who did it, and why. If you knew who to deal with, things could be traded for money, and money could be traded for food. Mr. Milgram accused no one. He simply looked out the window and said loud enough for all in the room to hear, "What a shame when Jew will steal from Jew." He found a candle stub and lit the tiny wick with a match. He looked at Janina and me. "Who will be the menorah?" The menorah was the candle holder. "I will," I said. He gave me the candle. He made for it a collar of newspaper so the hot wax would not drip on my hand. I stood at attention and held my arms out and did my best to imitate a menorah. Mr. Milgram said the words and sang. I asked him if I could sing the song I learned at Dr. Korchak's orphanage. His eyes glistened in the light from my candle. "Yes. Yes." So I sang my song, a singing candle holder, and Mr. Milgram and the twins danced in a circle and laughed. Janina refused to get up from the floor. So the days of Hanukkah went. When the candle burned away, Mr. Milgram struck a match and said that maybe it would last for 8 days, like the oil in the story. But it burned away before he finished speaking. "So," he said, "we ourselves will be the candle flames." He put his hands on his chest. "Feel your hearts, how warm they are." And I did. I could feel my heart getting warm. I could feel the flame in my chest as we danced in a circle. Each night I went out for food, but Janina stayed behind. She never left the room. She never spoke. She even stopped complaining. I combed her hair for hours each day, but I could not comb a smile onto her face. I also was losing my happy. Then an idea came to me. Although Janina did not like her comb, I knew of something she would like very much. Almost every time she ate, I heard her mutter, "I wish I had a pickled egg." I knew about pickled herring, but not pickled eggs. I thought, I'll find an egg and a pickle. There was only one day of Hanukkah left. That night, when I went to the other side, I forgot about everything else. I could not remember seeing an egg in my smuggling searches, but then I hadn't been looking for eggs. I knew eggs were kept in cool places, so I looked in iceboxes and basements. I went to all my best houses, plus the Blue Camel Hotel, and found not a single egg. As for pickles, I was hoping for the fat, juicy kind that Uri used to eat, but the best I could do was a jar of pickle spears in someone's pantry. I was traveling light this night, so I just took a couple of spears from the jar and put them in my pocket. Now all I needed was an egg. It had begun to snow. I lurked down alleyways, jiggling strange doors and windows, trying to get in somewhere. There were more ruins now, after the Russians' bombing. Parts of heaven were beginning to look like the ghetto. At last I found an egg. Not in a great house, but in a shoemaker's shop. And not in an icebox, but sitting on a scrap of leather on a workbench. I cradled the egg in my hand. I knew how fragile they were. I could already hear Janina's joyful squeal. On the way back, out on the street, I heard a whistle blast. I thought nothing of it. The jackboots were after someone. The whistle kept getting louder, and then a shouting voice, "Yuda! Yuda!" I didn't understand. No one ever stopped me over here. I ran. A second voice was shouting. Snowflakes pelted my face. I kept my fingers loose about the egg. I could not run in a straight line, for there were craters in the streets from the bombing. And I could not lead them to the hole in the wall. I darted into an alley and into the shadows and deep into a heap of rubble. I crouched, panting, pressing the cold, smooth egg to my lips. The shouts and whistles grew faint. I waited for a long time. The snow piled on my hat and collar. I could smell the pickles in my pocket. I warmed the egg with my breath. The sky was turning from black to gray when I made my way back to the two-brick hole. I reached to the other side and laid the egg in the snow and wriggled after it. I had been having no problems getting through lately. Big Henrik's walloping must have worked. The moment I returned to the ghetto side, I realized why the jackboots had been after me. I had forgotten to take off my armband. I had been announcing to all of Warsaw, "Look, I'm a Jew, escaped from the ghetto." It was a wonder they hadn't noticed me sooner. Darkness, my friend, was leaving. I had to hurry. I ran, dashing around a corner. I tripped over a body half hidden in the snow and went sprawling on the sidewalk. The egg flew from my hand. At first I was happy for the pillow of snow. But when I picked up the egg, I saw in the dim light that the shell was cracked. I was heartbroken. All the dangers it had survived, only to come to this. And then I noticed that it was only cracked, not broken apart. There was no yellow seeping into the snow. I didn't understand. An egg that cracked but didn't break. It was a miracle. I ran the rest of the way, veering around bodies. Mr. Milgram was already awake when I got home. Janina was sleeping. I showed him the egg and the pickle spears. "For Janina," I whispered. "Happy." He looked at the egg and pickle spears, but he looked longer at me. "Look at the egg," I said. "It doesn't break. Is it a miracle?" He studied the egg. He held it to his ear and shook it. He nodded. "No," he whispered. "The miracle is you. The egg is hard-boiled. It will not break." A hard-boiled egg. This was new to me. I hoped Janina would like it. That night I gave it to her. Her eyes bulged like birds' eggs. She peeled off the shell and shoved the whole egg into her mouth. She closed her eyes and made little sounds as she ate it. "Wait," I said. "Pickles." I held them out. "Pickled egg." She waved the pickles away. "Pickled eggs are purple," she mumbled through the mush in her mouth. The twins were staring. Their teeth were going up and down with hers. When she finished eating the egg, she hugged her father and said, "Thank you." "Thank Misha," he said. "It was his idea. He found it on the other side." She hugged me. I was surprised she could squeeze so hard. Uncle Shepsel returned. He came to the room only to eat and sleep now. He believed that the less time he spent with Jews, the more Lutheran he became. But even Lutherans get hungry, and when he came in the door, he sniffed the air and said, "Pickles." To my surprise, Mr. Milgram took a pickle spear from his pocket and gave it to Uncle Shepsel. As for me, I had been awake too long. I lay down. I felt a comb in my hair, combing, combing. 35. Spring. "What's that?" Janina said. She went to the window. The twins ran after her. We were in the room. It was day. There were voices outside the window. I joined the others. In the courtyard below, children were singing. They sounded more like crows than like children. When they sensed we were watching from above, they turned their faces up to us, all rags and eyes. "Why are they singing?" I said. Mr. Milgram's voice came over my shoulder. "They are hungry. They're singing for food." "We have no food," I said. This was true. When Janina and I returned from heaven each night, she was going out with me again. We dropped something through the window of Dr. Korchak's orphanage and brought the rest straight home and ate it at once. "Come away from the window, children," said Mr. Milgram. The singing in the courtyard went on for a while. Then it went away. The flies were always singing. The days were warm and the bodies were cold, and the flies were singing and drinking at the eyes and boils of the children. No one took from the bodies under the newspapers, as there were no clothes left to take, no shoes, only rags. I believed I saw angels lurking behind the eyes of the living, waiting. Angels and crows passed each other, one leaving, the other coming. Every day, a parade of body wagons backed up at the Ganshe Street gate of the cemetery. Smugglers hung like sad fruits from lampposts with signs around their necks. The piper marched up and down the streets and blew his silver flute and cried out, "Come to the Candy Mountain!" On Sundays, the jackboots came with their girlfriends to pinch their noses and take pictures and toss pieces of bread to us pigeons. One soldier made the others laugh. He wore a clothespin on his nose. Food was harder and harder to find, even in heaven. Sometimes all I could find was green bread. Sometimes there was nothing in a garbage can but drippings of fat in the bottom. I had no container, so I scooped 2 handfuls and returned with fat. The others ate the fat from my hands. Even with smuggled food, Janina had gotten thinner and thinner. Her face had become as thin as a fox's, while the rest of her became smaller. Her eyes grew larger. In other ways, Janina was her old self again, chattering, complaining, shadowing me everywhere I went, and everything I did. She made me self-conscious. I hesitated to do things that had always come naturally. I had stopped harassing Bufo so that Janina would also stop, but it didn't work. In fact, she even went further. She became a gnat in the nose of every flop she saw. She called them names. She threw stones. She sneaked up behind them and whacked them on the backs of their knees with a metal pipe. I smacked her. I shouted at her, but I could not change her. I could not understand her moods, her outbursts. I mostly accepted the world as I found it. She did not. She smacked me back and kicked me. In time, I found my own best way to deal with her. On many days, I went off to a favorite bomb crater and lowered myself into it and licked traces of fat from between my fingers and closed my eyes and remembered the good old days when ladies walked from bakeries with bulging bags of bread. 36. 1 minute I was walking alone. I was heading for the bomb crater, and the next minute someone was beside me. I gave a yelp. "Uri!" He had not been around in a long time. I hugged him. He pushed me away. "Shut up," he said. "Just listen." He smacked me on the back of the head. "Are you listening?" "Yes," I said. "Get out," he said. "Get out?" He wore a blue and white armband just like mine. "I'm not going to say it again. Get out." I was confused. "Get out of where?" "Out of the ghetto, out of Warsaw, out of everywhere. Just get out. Go, and don't look back." There were no scabs or boils on Uri's face. He wore clothes. Shoes. A hollow-eyed rag-draped skeleton appeared before us. I could not tell if it was a boy or a girl. It held out its hand. Uri pulled a fat pickle from his pocket. He bit off a piece, took the piece from his mouth, and gave it to the hand. We walked on. "Why?" I said. "Deportations," he said. "They're going to begin soon. They're clearing out the ghetto." Deportations. They're going to get rid of all of you, take you away on trains." This sounded good to me. "Where?" I said. "Russia? Washington, America?" He curled his fingers around my neck. He squeezed. "I don't know." "You don't want to know. Whatever you do, do not get on a train. Do not be here when the trains come. Just go. Get out. Run. Don't stop running." He looked at the sky. "Ever." I looked at the sky with him, but nothing was there. He stared at me. "I never asked you. How do you get to the other side?" I told him about the 2-brick hole. He wagged his head. He almost grinned. "You little turd. I knew you'd be good for something." "Remember when I saw you in the Blue Camel Hotel?" I said excitedly. He bounced a knuckle off my forehead. "You didn't see me anywhere, you hear? You never saw me. You don't know me." Another knuckle. "You understand?" I nodded. But I did not understand. "I have to go," he said. "Here." He gave me the rest of the pickle. He stepped back. He stared at me up and down. He wagged his head. He looked sad. Darker than ever. He spit on his finger and rubbed my cheek. "Before you go, find some water and wash your face." He reached into a rubble of bricks and pulled out a handful of white dust. "See this? Rub your face with it, your hands." He washed my hands in the dust. They became whiter than his. "See? Before you go," pointing to my armband, "take off that thing." He grabbed my hair and shook my head till I was dizzy. "Do not look at anyone. Do not stop for anything. You are not a Jew. You are not a gypsy. You are nobody. He slapped my face. Say it. I am nobody. He let me go. He backed off. His red hair was cut so short it was just a tinge of rust creeping out of his cap. He turned and walked away. He came back. He squeezed my neck. Tell no one but the boys, he said. He looked about. How are they? Are they all right? Not Oleg, I said. Oleg is hanged with a sign. Uri stared at me. They smuggle like me, but not through the hole. They're too big. Uri looked at the sky for a long time. He closed his eyes. He looked back to me. He reached into his pocket and handed me something. Here. He walked away for good. It was a piece of candy. The chocolate coat was melting. I ate it. It was a butter cream with a hazelnut heart. I went straight to the boys at the butcher shop ruins. I told them I had seen Uri. He says we must go. Kuba laughed. Go! Go where? Out of the ghetto, I said. Out of everywhere. Run! Run forever! Kuba and Ferdy laughed. Ines did not. Why? He said. Deportation. The boys looked at one another. What's that mean? Said Ferdy. I don't know, said Ines, but I could tell that he did. Big Henrik boomed. Run! I saved the pickle for my family. As they chewed the pieces, I said, We must go. I said it in a whisper so the new people in the room would not hear.
What are you talking about? Said Uncle Shepsel.
Uri says the trains are coming to take us away. He says we have to run.
Who is Uri? Said Mr. Milgram.
Uri is my friend.
Your friend is cuckoo, said Uncle Shepsel. Why would they take you anywhere? They already have you like pigs in a pen. What else can they do to you? And I say you, he pointed to each of us, because I am no longer one of you.
He licked pickle juice from his lip.
I am a Lutheran. Everyone knows. I have nothing to fear. I am only thinking of you.
He jabbed his book in Mr. Milgram's face.
With your Hanukkahs and stubbornness. You.
Janina pulled on her father's sleeve.
I want to go away on the train, Tata.
Mr. Milgram patted her hand. There will be no train. Uncle Shepsel is right. There is nothing else they can do to us. 37. Summer. Janina was the first to hear it. We had just wriggled through the hole back into the ghetto. My pockets were stuffed with chunks of rotten cabbages.
What's that? She said.
We listen. In the black distance, there was a faint sound of metal clanking, screeching.
I don't know, I said.
She yelped. It's the trains! She ran. She ran stupidly down the middle of the street, ignoring the shadows. Onions bounced from her pockets. I ran after her. The clanking and screeching became louder. Janina, stop! I tried to shout without shouting. Curfew began when the sun went down. Nighttime was dangerous for everyone, not just smugglers. I caught her. I held her by the arms as she tried to kick me. I wanted to hit her, but I was afraid to let go. They'll shoot you, you stupid girl! I felt her shoulders slump. She relaxed. She was giving up. I let go. She turned suddenly and raised up on her tiptoes and bashed her forehead into my nose. I howled. Tears leaped to my eyes. When I finally managed to see, she was gone.
Good, I whispered. Stupid girl.
I threw a stone. I shouted as loud as I could.
Stupid girl!
I tried to go home. I tried to sit in the shadows and wait for her to come back. In the end, all I could do was start walking toward the noises in the night. They were coming from Stavki Station, the railroad yard just on the other side of the ghetto wall. I had long since discovered that the two-brick hole I used nightly was not the only one in the wall. Near the Stavki Street gate, there was another. I wriggled through it and found myself once again outside the wall. I saw that there was not one train, but many. Thick yellow light came from lamps, hung high on a forest of poles. Locomotives huffed and whistled and blew steam from their wheels. Endless lines of boxcars vanished into the blackness. Jackboots and jackdogs flashed from the shadows. Uri was right. I found Janina sitting on a collapsed smokestack. I could not help myself. I climbed up beside her. We watched a train come in and line up with the others.
Where will they go?
She said. never taking her eyes from the trains.
Where will they take us?
You don't want to know, I said.
Do you know?
Yes, I lied. But I'm not telling you, punishing her. We watched some more. She said, I know where they're going.
Where?
I said. She nodded like her father did when he was saying something important.
They're going to the Candy Mountain.
We said nothing of the trains the next day. We didn't have to. Everyone in the ghetto knew. The words were in the air, buzzing with the flies. Trains, deportations, Stufki Station.
Why? Where?
Uncle Shepsel became more and more agitated. He wagged his book at the new people. He ranted at the people on the stairway. He called down from the window to the courtyard,
Jews, repent! It is not too late! Come with me! Save yourselves!
At the butcher shop ruins, Enos laughed and laughed. He stood on a pile of bricks and spread his arms and shouted,
They're doing it! They're really doing it!
The piper marched in the streets. Sounds of singing came through the open windows of the orphanage. All eyes and ears turned toward Stavki Station. Even the mourning corpses seemed to be listening. Two nights after we first saw the trains, as we returned from the garbage cans of heaven, we heard the sounds. Gunshots, whistles, screams, snarling dogs. When we came to the two-brick hole, we peeked through, our heads pressed together, one eye apiece. People were going by, many of them, down the middle of the street. Everyone carried a suitcase. My first stupid thought was, parade. Then I saw the jackboots poking them with rifles and the dogs lunging and snapping. The people went by so slowly, the feet seemed to slide along the street, not walk. They did not look like they were going to the Candy Mountain. I thought they would never pass. The next day, the streets were empty. Voices in the stairway and the courtyard said, There is a quota. The trains must take 5,000 Jews every day. Voices. 10,000. Voices. Until... And then someone said, Resettlement. What did he mean? Resettlement? What resettlement? They have had enough of us here, the someone said. They are sick of us. They are kicking us out. They are sending us to the east, to resettlement. We will have our own villages. No one but Jews. The word resettlement took the place of the word deportation.
Still, said Uncle Shepsel, it is better not to be a Jew in the first place.
And the jackboots came in the day and the night, and the whistles blew. One block, one street at a time. Schlieska Street, Pinska Street, Tvarda Street. Every day, every night, the slow gray parade shuffled towards Stavki Station. The people on the stairway muttered, Resettlement. Resettlement. We will be free. I will mend shoes again. We will eat. The people looked into each other's eyes and nodded and said,
Yes. Yes.
Still, they did not go outside. The streets remained empty, except for the piper. Sometimes when Janina and I climbed down through the people on the stairway at night, a voice would say, Don't go. You'll miss the resettlement. Tseglana Street. Khodna Street. One day, Mr. Milgram said to me, Stay close to Janina, wherever you go, every second, day and night. His hand was on my shoulder. I was shocked. Not that he knew she went out with me at night, but that he was allowing her to do so. There was one thing Mr. Milgram did not know, how much his daughter loved the trains. Every night when we crawled back through the hole to the ghetto, she ran for the courtyard. She dumped her food under a porch where she could get it later and ran off to the hole in the wall near the Stavki Street gate and squirted herself back to the other side. I remembered Mr. Milgram's orders. I had no choice but to follow. Night after night we did this. We stood at the end of the fallen smokestack and stared at the trains coming and going, the parades of people climbing into the boxcars. The screech of wheels, the clack of dogs' teeth, the locomotives coughing like dying Jews. In the days I went to the butcher shop ruins, but the boys were disappearing one by one.
Where's Ferdy?
I asked.
Where's Kuba?
No answer. Had they taken Uri's advice? Did they run away?
Were they on the other side of the wall, running? Were they hanging from lampposts with signs around their necks? Were they in the sewers? Had Bufo found them? Ferdi, Kuba, Inas, one by one, until only Big Henrik was left, clumping after the piper. I saw Jackboots pointing at them. No one came to take pictures anymore. All day, all night, parades of people. One day I was dozing in the milkweed alley when Janina came calling, "Misha! Misha!" She grabbed my hand and pulled me out to the street. The orphans were going by. They were marching. Their heads were high, and they were singing the song I had learned. I sang along with them. Not one was dressed in rags. Everyone wore shoes. Dr. Korchak led the way. He marched as straight as a jackboot. He wore a hat with a little red feather. We stood there until I could no longer see them, no longer hear them. Libelta Street, Vavova Street. 38. And then the old man was there. It was strange. He was not there, and then suddenly he was. He did not even have rags on his feet. One eye was the color of milk. It never blinked. "I have come back," he said. We were gathered around him in the courtyard. "I am here to tell you. I escaped. I saw. There is no resettlement," someone called. "Of course there is resettlement. We go to villages in the east. They are waiting for us." The man repeated, "There is no resettlement. It is a lie." "You lie!" Another someone called. "Look!" someone else called, waving a piece of paper. "This is a postcard from my brother. He says he is doing fine. Listen, we are doing fine. We are happy in our new village. We hope to see you soon." "Lies," said the old man. He did not shout. We had to strain to hear him. He looked and he sounded as if he wanted to sleep. "It is a trick. Your brother is dead." There was a shriek. Many shouted at once at the old man, "Go away! Go away!" Only when the shouting died down did we know that the old man was saying more. "Fences that fry, prison coops, ovens, never stop. Ashes fall like snow." There was silence. Someone said, "Ovens? Are they baking pies for us?" Laughter. "Ovens for what?" came another voice. The old man raised his head, his milky eye turned to the speaker. "For you." Silence again, and then a burst of laughter and jeers. "You are crazy, old man. We have postcards." The old man wobbled. I leaned my shoulder into his hip to hold him up. Above me, I heard his ragged breathing. The people waited for him to say more, but he only turned and walked away. A voice, Uncle Shepsel's, cried out, "Jews, repent! It is not too late." The day after the old man spoke in the courtyard, Mr. Milgram whispered to me in a corner of the room, "When you and Janina go out tonight, I want you to stay on the other side. I want you to run away. Don't come back. Keep Janina with you. Take her hand." First Uri, now my father. "Janina wants to go on the train," I told him. "She wants to go to the Candy Mountain." Mr. Milgram's eyes slowly closed. Like Janina's, they had become enormous, as if to hold his sadness. "There is no Candy Mountain," he said. At that moment, I knew. The old man in the courtyard had been telling the truth, and I understood why Mr. Milgram had not forbidden Janina to go out. He knew that when the parade to the trains came by, a child might be safer away from home. He stared into my eyes. He gripped my forearm. "Take her hand. Keep her with you. Make her go. Take off your armbands and run. Run until daylight, then hide. Run at night." He squeezed my arm so hard I would have thought he was trying to hurt me if I hadn't known better. "Do not bring back food tonight. Do not return. Run. Run." That night, Mr. Milgram was not sleeping when we got up to go. He pressed us into himself for a long time. I think he was crying. He whispered words in our ears that I did not understand and let us go.
When we got to the other side that night, I took Janina's hand, as Mr. Milgram had told me. At first, she said nothing. When she saw we were not stopping at garbage cans, she planted her feet and said, "Where are we going?" "I don't know," I said. "We're just going." She yanked her hand out of mine and stomped off. I went after her and grabbed her hand back. "Tata said to come with me."
"Where?"
"Away. Now run." I started to run, pulling her along. She jammed her heels into the sidewalk and screamed and kicked me. Just when I thought she was finished with me, she spat on my shirt and stomped on my foot. I screamed. She ran off. We did not go to the trains that night. We returned to the room with brown cabbages and fat. Mr. Milgram was still awake. He squeezed my arm and shook me.
"What did I tell you?"
I could not see his face in the darkness, but his voice was furious. I think he wanted to smack me. Then he pressed us again into himself. This is how it went for a number of nights. Mr. Milgram told me, and then the both of us, not to return. Janina refused to obey. We returned to the furious voice and the smack that never came. Zamenhof Street, Niwa Street, Lubetsky Street. And then, one night, we could not come back. 39. Our pockets were stuffed with dried herring. Janina smelled like salt and fish. When we came near our two-brick hole, we saw lights and people. We hid in the shadows and waited. Finally, the lights went out and the people left. We ran to the hole. It wasn't there. Only an unbroken flatness of brick. We crept along the wall. We went into Stavki station. Boxcar doors were clanking, swallowing whole parades of people. Aching to get back to the ghetto, we looked for the Stavki station hall that we had been coming through to see the trains. It too was gone. "There's other holes," I said. All night long we darted from shadow to shadow along the never-ending wall, dodging jackboot guards, searching for a way into the ghetto. There were guards and lights and flat brick wall, but no holes. We heard gunshots and screams coming from the ghetto, dogs barking, glow of flamethrowers. Janina became more and more agitated. Whenever she heard a gunshot, she piped, "Tata!" She kicked at the wall. "He's all right," I told her. I hugged her. The sky was gray. The stars were fading when we got back to where we started. Daylight was coming, and we were stuck in heaven. I found white dust at the base of the wall. I washed my face and hands in it. Janina laughed. She smacked me with a dried fish. Then we ate it. We slept on the ground in the merry-go-round park. We woke at noon and walked about the city. I remember Uri's words. I told Janina, "Don't look guilty." "What's guilty?" she said. "I forget," I said. "Just don't look it." I reached into her pocket and pushed her crumpled armband deeper out of sight. We wandered the streets among the people and bomb craters, chewing dried fish. We made a game. Who could look less guilty? We laughed. We said hello to people. We ran back to the merry-go-round to ride the horses, but the horses were still. I kept listening for the tootling music, but all I heard were gunshots from the other side of the wall. When night returned, we approached the wall, and I realized how stupid I was. What had I been thinking? Were the holes going to come back? Was the wall going to be lower than last night? I wished we had Big Henrik's shoulders to climb on. I tried to think. Suddenly Janina ran to the wall and cupped her hands about her mouth and yelled with all her might, "Tata!" I tackled her and rolled us into the shadows as a jackboot down the wall turned. Just to be doing something, we began another tour around the wall. When we came to Stavki station, where it was always daytime, with the lights and trotting people and clanking boxcars, I suddenly knew what to do. The Stavki Street gate in the wall was open. People were parading through. I grabbed her hand, pulled her along. We crouched behind a shed near the gate. Jackboots with dogs guarded both sides of the gate. The people slumped along with their suitcases, heads hung low, as if they did not know the teeth of the dogs were snapping into their faces. I did not bother to give Janina instructions. Why should I? She copied everything I did.
I dashed for the parade of people. I plunged into them. I lost myself among their legs. While they headed for the trains, I groped and shouldered in the opposite direction. They paid no more attention to me than to the dogs. When I sensed I had passed through the gate to the ghetto side, I broke sharply to my right, popped out of the parade, and bolted. There were dogs and shouts behind me, then gunshots. My first prayer plucked at my lips. No flamethrowers, please! But by then there were shadows and rubble, and I was tucked into a pocket of blackness like a rat. I did not know if she was with me until my own heart and lungs calmed down. Then I could hear her panting beside me. When no one seemed about, we ran for home. I knew the news was bad as we raced up the steps. There were no bodies to hurdle. The squatters were gone. Our door was open. Moonlight misted from the window like winter breath. The room was empty. The table and chair were overturned. The pill cabinet was smashed. Janina cried out. She flung herself onto the floor and into the corners. She scrubbed the shadows with her body, hoping he was only hiding, not gone. She whimpered along the walls. Tata. Tata. She ran to the window. Tata! Where was Uncle Shepsel? I expected him to arise any moment in the middle of the room and declare, I tried to warn them, the Jews. They would not listen. Then I saw it, in the moonlight on the floor, the Book of Lutherans. Janina knocked me aside as she ran from the room and down the steps. I ran after her, across the courtyard, down the middle of the moonlit streets to Stufki Station. The endless parade was still shuffling through the gate into the yellow light. I lost her as she plunged into the people. I did likewise. The dogs gasped on their leashes, but no one tried to stop us. On the other side of the wall, I made my way from side to side of the parade, bouncing off suitcases, searching for her. Whistles shrieked. Boxcar doors screamed. Dogs yapped and snarled. Jackboots and dogs and bayonets threw gigantic jerking shadows on the ground. I kept working my way backward through the parade so I would not be carried to the boxcars. I peeked out from the people, searching, keeping myself hidden among the shuffling legs and suitcases. Then I saw her. Or did I? Was it really her? How could I be sure? It was 4 or 5 boxcars down the line. Everything, the people's heads, the straining dogs, the roofs of the boxcars, was in black silhouette against the sickly light. She was a shadow cut loose, held above the other shadows by a pair of jackboot arms. She was thrashing and screaming above the silent masses. I could not make out her words, but the sound of the voice was hers, and I was running, breaking from the parade, and running toward her. And then the arms came forward, and she was flying. Janina was flying over the shadow heads and the dogs and soldiers, her arms and legs turning slowly. She seemed so light, so right for the air. I thought, she's happy. I thought she would sail forever like a milkweed puff on an endless breeze, and I was running and wishing I could fly with her. And then she was gone, swallowed by the black maw of the boxcar. And even as I felt the hot breath of the dog, I could hear the rumble and the boxcar door clanking shut. I tried to run to her, but the dog wouldn't let me go. And then the dog was gone, and a boot came swinging, and I was kicked so hard I popped off the ground. When I landed, a club pounded my shoulders, and I was kicked again, and the jackboot was dragging me by the hair, and there was laughing and clacking of jackdog teeth. The jackboot flung me against the wall. I saw his hand go to his holster. I saw the gun come out and point between my eyes. Die, piglet! The voice. I looked up. The red hair, the face. Uri! I cried, and the gun went off. 40. Then. My nose tickled, my cheek. I brushed away the tickles. They came back. Snips of buzzing. I opened my eyes, white clouds sailing across a blue sky, darting spots. Flies. Something was ringing. My ear hurt. My arm hurt. Everything hurt. I was wet. I was in water. I sat up. I was in a puddle of water in a ditch. I started to climb out of the ditch and fell back. The ringing would not stop. I looked at my arm where the teeth of the dog had shaken me. The gash was crusty, like dark red bread. Flies danced over it. I stared at them. They were busy. I put my hand to my ear, the one with the missing earlobe. I felt a crusty lump, but not much more. I sat back and closed my eyes and listened to the ringing. Janina. I scrambled up from the ditch. Stufki station was empty. No jackboots. No Jews. The trains were gone. The gate was closed. I headed for the empty tracks. I felt dizzy. Then I was waking up on the ground. I tried again. The world wobbled. I saw something in the hard dirt. I reached to pick it up and got dizzy and fell on my head. I cried out and went to sleep. When I opened my eyes, it was right there. A black shredded scrap. Her shoe. That I had seen my face in. I would have known it anywhere. I ran my fingertips over it. I smiled. I picked it up and picked myself up and wobbled on. I came to the edge of the platform. I sat down, my feet dangling toward the tracks below. The ringing was loud. I felt dizzy again. When I woke up, I was on the tracks, the shoe in my fist. The tracks curved out of the station. I started to walk. I walked out of the station yard, out of the world. The tracks came to a point in the sky. 41. I came to a boy. He was throwing stones down the track. A black and white dog was with him. When the dog saw me, it came running. I was afraid, but the dog wagged its tail and licked the crusty gash on my arm. "Who are you?" said the boy. He wore shoes, clothes, no boils. "Misha," I said, "do you have water?" The sun flashed off the steel rail. "Where is your ear?" said the boy. "Stufki station." "Where are you going?" he said. "To the ovens." "What ovens?" "Where the trains go." "Why are you going to the ovens?" "That's where Janina is," I said. "Do you know her?" He shook his head. "Do you know Uri? Do you know Dr. Korchak? Do you have water?" "Can I touch your ear?" I said yes. He reached out. I think he touched it, but I could not feel. He looked at me. "Are you a Jew?" "Yes." I pulled the armband from my pocket. I slipped it onto my good arm. "See?" "Yes." He disappeared into the weeds with the dog. He returned with a pan of water. I drank it. I walked on. Day, night, day, night. I ate blackberries from thorny whips that reminded me of barbed wire. I pulled scallions from the earth. I drank from ditches. And when I bent to cup my hands in the water, the ringing pulsed in my eyes. The steel rails flashed in the sun. I shivered as if it were winter. My wounded ear would not dry out. I awoke in the weeds. I awoke on the tracks. The steel rails wobbled away from me like silvery snakes. I was in many places, and I was not alone. Bufo was there, smiling, waiting for me. I could smell the mint. The blue man rode the merry-go-round to the tootling music. I saw bodies wrapped in newspaper floating above the sidewalks. I felt Uri smack me in the head and call me stupid. I saw Himmler's car stop and Himmler himself get out and march right up to me and snap his heels together and salute me and say, "Hanukkah." I saw the orphans. They were marching down the tracks led by Dr. Korchak. The orphans were marching and singing, their shoes all hitting the ground at once, and the oven door opened, and into the oven they went, heads held high, marching and singing. Every day, Mr. Milgram stroked my hair. Every day I heard Kuba laughing. Every day I looked for Janina, and every day she was not there. I was used to her constant presence, to her mimicking everything I did. I kept glancing around to see myself repeated. But there was only me. One day when I opened my eyes, a man was standing over me. 42. The man placed his foot on my chest. "You're a Jew," he said. "Yes," I answered. I pointed to my armband. "See? What are you doing here?" I'm following the train. Janina, I'm going to the ovens.
What ovens?
The ovens for the Jews. I'm a filthy son of Abraham. They forgot me. Can you take me to the ovens?
The man spit in the weeds. I don't know what you're talking about. You make no sense. Are you insane?
That word was new to me.
I don't know, but I'm stupid and tiny and fast.
He jerked me to my feet.
Tiny is right.
He tore the armband away. What happened to your ear?
Uri did it.
He tried to kill me, but he missed.
Come with me, he said.
I took a step and fell back to the ground. When I awoke, I was bouncing in a cart pulled by a donkey. When it stopped, the man slung me over his shoulder and dumped me into a heap of hay in a barn. The farmer's wife came and gave me water and a carrot to eat. With water and rags, she cleaned my wounded ear. Then she tied a rag around my head that covered the ear and one eye.
Do you know Uri?
I said. She tied another rag around my crusty arm.
Did you see Janina?
She touched my forehead.
You're burning, and you stink.
The farmer's wife put me in a wooden tub and scrubbed me until I screamed. She brought me clothes. She burned my old ones with the shoe in the pocket. The wife came every day and cleaned my ear and my arm and felt my forehead and gave me water and carrots and boiled turnips. I slept in the hay and played with the mice in the barn. One was my favorite. I shared my turnips with it. I called it Janina. I taught it to run up my arm and stand on my head. Then a cat ate it. One day I awoke and the ringing was gone. I walked out of the barn and through the fields until I came to the tracks. A spot of white caught my eye. The armband, snagged on a thorn bush. I stuffed it into my pocket. I had been walking the tracks for a long time when the farmer stopped me. "Where are you going?" he said. "To the ovens." The farmer knocked me down with a swat of his hand, and I was back in the donkey cart with a rope around my neck. I was tied to a stable post in the barn. I remembered Uri's story of my beginnings of becoming a slave to farmers. Maybe the story wasn't made up after all. Maybe I was catching up with my life. After some days, the farmer's wife came to the barn and said, "You must not run away. There is a new law. All children must work on the farms."
"Then to the ovens?"
I said.
"Yes,"
she said.
"Then."
43. I slept in the barn, ate in the barn, worked in the barn. When I wasn't working in the barn, I worked in the fields. I hauled rocks to the donkey cart. I picked bugs from the vegetables. When I wasn't picking them for myself, I learned to milk the cow. One day the cow kicked me. I told it what happened to the cow in the ghetto. The farmer's wife, her name was Elzbieta, fed me with the pigs. The pig's toilet was my toilet. Every night I was tied to the stable post. Sometimes in the night, on the far side of the fields, I heard the huffing of locomotives and the clack of iron wheels. Many times I asked Elzbieta, the wife, "When will the law be over? When can I go to the ovens?"
"Soon," she always said.
"But you must not run away. If you do, the Nazis will burn down the farm and feed us to the pigs." So I worked and waited and talked with the donkey and the mice. Then one day a man came in a horse and cart and said something to the farmer and went away. Later I heard the farmer shouting in the house. That night I was awakened by a voice, the wife's.
"Run!"
The rope around my ankle was gone. There was something under my shirt, against my skin. Bread. I ran. The war was over. I had been on the farm for 3 years. I was back to walking the tracks. This time I had company. Thousands were trudging the tracks, the roads, the fields. No jackboots guarded them. There were carnivals, markets. They sprang up in fields along the railroad and were gone by next day. People sold things.
Shoes! Cigarette lighter! Apples!
Anything for money. Anything for food. I saw a tent made from bedsheets. A man was calling,
"Come in, come in! See Herr Hitler! Come right in! Only 50 zlotys!
I did not even have 1 zloty. I waited until someone was paying and slid under the bedsheet. Lying on the ground was a skeleton. Its bony feet had been stuffed into long black boots. A steel helmet swallowed half the grinning skull.
Another man called, 10 zlotys. You won't believe your eyes. There was no tent, only a handkerchief. A customer paid. The man stood in my way so I could not see. He lifted the handkerchief and let it fall. The customer wanted his money back. While the two fought on the ground, I lifted the handkerchief. It was something I had never seen, something Ferdy had said did not exist, something Mr. Milgram had said was like happy. It was an orange. The hucksters fascinated me the most. I stood in front of them for hours as they ranted to the passing parades about the wonders under their tents and handkerchiefs. They never stopped. They never ran out of words. When I lay down in weeds or a barn at night, I whispered into the dark, "Come and look! You won't believe your eyes!" I dreamed of bodiless jackboots tramping the earth. I dreamed of burning cows. I dreamed the stone angel looked down on me and said, "I am nobody." I walked the tracks and roads. I offered my services to farmers for food and a bed of straw in the barn. When there was no work, I took my food from wherever I could find it. I drank my water from bomb craters. I rode on trains. So did many others. I rode on boxcars and cinder cars and tankers. I rode 1,000 trains. None ever took me to Janina or to a candy mountain. Somewhere along the way, I heard the story of Hansel and Gretel, and I knew that the end was not true, that the witch did not die in the oven. One day I found myself back in the city of Warsaw. The bomb craters were gone. There was still rubble. Trucks and carts were hauling it away. I thought I heard a machine gun. I ducked into a doorway. It was a jackhammer. I saw people slumped in alleyways, but they were not covered in newspaper. They were sleeping for real. I found the ghetto. The wall was gone. I walked right in. I looked for Niska Street. I could not find it. I could not find our house, or the orphan's house, or Oleg hanging, or the rug we slept under. There was rubble, and there was nothing. Even the flies were gone. On the trains, I had heard about the revolt. Until then, I had thought I was the last one out of the ghetto. I did not know 40,000 people were still there. The following spring, as I hauled the farmers' rocks, the Jews turned on the jackboots with stolen guns and bottle bombs. But the jackboots were too many with their tanks and flamethrowers, and the revolt was over by May, and the people were herded to the last of the trains, and the ghetto was no more. Standing in the silent dust, I understood at last what Uri had done, and what he had saved me from. I understood that the Uri I knew, the real Uri, was not the one the Nazis knew. I smiled to think of him on the last day, once again in his own clothes, shaking his fist at the oncoming tanks, his red hair flaring, invisible no more, calling all the world's attention to himself. After I walked out of the ghetto that was no longer there, I wandered the streets of the city. I stole my food. One day, in a crowd on the sidewalk, I caught a whiff of mint. I stopped, looked about, ran back the other way. I stared into faces. I sniffed. There it was again, mint. A man's mouth was working, a fleck of green on his lip. A gristly, bony man, white whiskers, sunken eyes, ragged clothes, bare feet so dirty I thought at first he wore shoes or socks. No club, no fat belly. I planted myself in front of him. He stopped. "Fat man!" His head didn't move. His eyes sagged down to me. I tugged on his rags. "Fat man!" His eyes were dead. "Fat man, it's me, Misha, me and Janina, remember?" He did not hear. I shook him. "Fat man, buffo, you hate me, you want to kill me, here I am, here!" I took his hand and put it on my head. "Kill me!" His hand slid off my head and flopped to his side. I punched him in his bony stomach. "Fat man, look!" I pulled from my pocket something I had been carrying all this time. The armband, once blue and white, now mostly black. I rolled it up my sleeve. "Look, fat man, I'm a Jew, you have to kill me, look!" But he would not look. He shuffled into me, almost knocking me down, and shuffled away. I watched until he was lost in the crowd. I took off the armband and let it fall to the sidewalk. 44. The world was returning to normal.
But for me, there was no normal to return to. Normal for me was stolen bread and ditch water. Little by little, I learned about forks and money and toothpaste and toilets. Back in the countryside, I did what I did best. I stole. I snatched everything I could carry. I became my own donkey. I pulled a little cart everywhere I went.